Commander Rappard, reel 18. Now, then I think the next thing that is the operations in the Minches. You'd been doing these various sweeps, anti-submarine sweeps, without any success for the 21st Escort Group for quite a while. And then suddenly there was quite a fair bit when you caught three submarines in the Minches, of which one was relevant to you on the 27th of March 1945. Now, what can you remember of the sweeps through the Minches?
Vividly, I think I remember the beauty of the hills in the Western Isles, and the fact that in the Minches you're in calm water, which is a tremendous advantage of a ship that rails about the whole time. And they're fairly narrow space between the islands and the mainland. And we were aware that something had been attacked or sunk up there, and that we'd been told for whatever reason to do an offensive patrol, in effect, to sweep that area. As usual, a rocky bottom, we were finding a lot of contacts which had to be evaluated very carefully. And it's a fairly long, drawn-out process, not least because the ship moving in the current, and of course the tides produce currents in those areas, makes it seem, when you listen to the noise of the echo coming back, as though the whatever the target is that you're on is moving. The transmitted pulse of the ASDIC makes a particular noise when you listen to it in the headphones. And then you hear the echo coming back either slightly higher or slightly lower, which would mean that the target is either going towards you or away from you. You then have to decide whether or not it's a rock on the bottom, and say so look at it from different angles. We also had more than one ASDIC set. One was to detect the range and bearing. Then we had a thing called a 147, which was a sort of sword hanging down from the bottom of the ship, where you could alter the angle of it backwards and incline it, so that you were able to look down and have a shadow effect on something on the bottom. In the ideal circumstance of a submarine lying on a flat sandy bottom, you could even see the periscope standards in the picture, which was drawn by the sonic trace. In a rocky bottom, you'd get all sorts of extraordinary things, and you'd have to interpret those. And the ASDIC ratings and whoever was the anti-submarine officer in the ship were responsible for doing that for the benefit of the captain, who then had to decide whether he had a submarine or whether it was something else. The Admiralty chart updates about where the wrecks were and what they looked like helped us to analyze what we were seeing. And the much more accurate navigational system from crossed radio beacons and so on enabled us to know exactly where we were, whereas hitherto in the war we'd not guessed where we were, but we certainly didn't know it within a matter of a few hundred yards. In those circumstances, we spent a lot of time looking at rocks, at shells of fish, occasionally blowing up shells of fish and scooping them up so that we could have fresh fish for the whole ship's company. And just occasionally, was it a submarine on the bottom? And when this particular event happened, we had a picture on the 147 trace which confirmed that it was a submarine. So the next trick was it able to fire torpedoes at us from its position on the bottom? Would they be homing torpedoes? Would they be the other sort of torpedoes? Or was it really pretending to be a wreck and a rock and would lie there? If it really was doing that, and it wasn't a submarine which had been sunk, which nobody knew about before, the only way we could actually find out was by opening it up. And we used to think of it as opening up a sardine can. And we'd drop depth charge on it and perhaps fire the hedgehog head-thrown mortar at it. And eventually this one did produce oil, and it did produce some bits which we retrieved. But we knew that the Germans occasionally squirted out of their torpedo tubes exactly the sort of things we would expect to find if we'd cracked open the hull of one of these submarines. But if they were too big to fit in a torpedo tube, then we would know we'd actually achieved it. Well, with this one, I don't remember that we knew for certain that we'd achieved it. And eventually, after 2 or 3 days of this business of pounding it, we moved away because we reckoned that there wasn't anything else we could do under those circumstances. We got samples of the oil and we'd picked up various things which would have to be sent off to the Admiralty. But we didn't know we'd sunk it. Eventually, we went to another of these patrols in the Southern Islands.
Now, was the Minch's one was later found to be the U-722.
So I believe, yes.
27th of March, 1945. Of course, you had no idea
I had no idea about that at the time.
And no, sorry, I was interrupting you.
That's all right.
The other one.
We moved away for another patrol. Whether we went back to Belfast first or not, I can't now remember. But we were doing another of these offensive patrols in the Southern Irish Sea when we got another contact. And working with the other ships, we did eventually open that one up and get evidence which to us seemed to be conclusive. But it takes quite a long time to do that.
Do you remember anything about that? That was the U-1001.
Again, we didn't know that.
You didn't know that, of course. Do you remember anything in particular about that?
Not really. We were becoming fairly hardened anti-submarine ships companies by then. And the process of endlessly dropping these charges, of opening up, of going to and fro with another ship, at least one other ship, meant that it was a team effort in order to stop these submarines attacking any passing ships. So we were winning there, we were achieving that objective if we kept them down and they couldn't get underway again, because they couldn't get near ships. Better still, if we actually sank them. And we thought we had sunk that one, but we couldn't prove it until later.
Now, when they returned to port, there was reference in the book of flying the homemade Jolly Rogers to indicate that you'd had a kill.
All sorts of things like that did happen occasionally. I didn't do it officially, and I can't remember it being done, although I do remember that sailors, very good for morale, say we were winning. So in principle, I was all for it. The captains tended to be just a little bit iffish about waving curious flags, especially when they hadn't had something confirmed.
Now, you were getting close to the end of the war there. That was on the 8th of April, just another month to go. Did you notice any change in the last month?
We had another patrol off Cape Roth. And during that patrol, one of our group was torpedoed. I can't remember the name of the ship.
Would that be the Red Mill? 27th of April.
Yes, Red Mill was the ship from which we'd transferred the doctor, and he was back serving on board. She was hit at a time when, in the Stoker's Mess Deck, I think, when a large piece of the plating on the hull wrapped itself around some of the poor doubles who were in their bunks in the mess deck. The ship was open to the Atlantic Ocean rollers up where we were, and it dipped underwater on the after end every time it went down. And quite clearly, they had no hope at all of getting these people out. The ship's doctor, a brave man, the same one who we'd dropped a boat on, went down and gave them an injection which enabled them to cope or kill them. They died anyway. It wasn't the ship I was in. I heard about it afterwards. I knew that it was happening, and I knew it was happening not far away from us. But under those circumstances, one was more concerned to avoid other ships being torpedoed. Our next job after that, that I recall, was to go to Loch Erebol and accept the surrender of the German submarines that came in at the end of the war. They were ordered to surface at a certain time and to wear a large black flag, stream a large black flag from the conning tower. Byron happened to be the ship in Loch Erebor, which was to be in the position near the entrance to the lock in northern Scotland, where we would board the submarines as they came in. And by chance, the first submarine that came in to surrender came into Loch Erebor. Although at the time, all the journalists were actually at Portsmouth down there and saying that submarine was the first, but it wasn't. I didn't go on board the first submarine. Boarding party went, and they did the proper boarding drill of dropping a chain down the conning tower so that the conning tower hatch could not be closed, and the submarine could not therefore dive while they were on board. And they took their Sten guns and they were armed to the teeth to do their job, and they took control of it. In the sort of euphoria you would expect at the end of a war like that, they hoisted the white ensign superior to the German naval ensign. And at that moment, the captain of the submarine, who I think was an ex-Merchant Navy officer, he was reported to have fainted, and some of the crew mutinied. In the subsequent excitement on board, which I did not see firsthand, a Sten gun was fired, and the outcome was that there was no further trouble. We left sentries, in effect, on board the submarine, and later that night, there was more trouble, which led to my removing all the drink from the submarine. And they had some superb wines and French liqueurs, all over stamped Wehrmacht in big letters. So we reported this to the senior officer, Doc Erebor, and the drill was that the boarding parties would immediately remove all the drink, because quite clearly this would stir things up and make it more difficult. When we had a batch of submarines, we escorted them down to Northern Ireland, where they were to be taken on the surrender. And my problem at Belfast was how to look after and indeed land a very large amount of superb liquor of various sorts we'd got on board. So I invited the customs to come on board. The customs chap in Northern Ireland duly came on board, and rather to my surprise said, oh, you can't trust these Germans. We better try it and see it's the real stuff. So we opened quite a few bottles. And one way or another, we proved that to our own satisfaction that it was the real stuff. And then we had to unload all this into a customs van. And we also had to unload the customs officer, who by then had enjoyed his tasting process. And it was all to go into Bonn, wasn't it? Which was why we couldn't have it. But rumor had it that some of it was on sale in the officers' club the next night in ashore. Of course, I couldn't prove anything like that, but it was a very strong rumor at the time.
And how did you feel at the end of the war? I mean, I forgot to ask you where you were on VE Day. Do you recall? That would be before this.
Well, this was before VE Day, because this was the end of the war day.
Right, sorry.
VE Day was a celebration much later.
Do you remember that?
Quite different event. I was no longer on board Byron. I'd been sent down because it was thought that my next job would be first turned to a fleet destroyer in the Far East. And I was therefore doing Dryad, HMS Dryad, working in the operations rooms there, under training, in effect, to be second in command of a fleet destroyer, with all the modern equipment which was being fitted to them. And one of the leading Wrens running the dummy operations rooms there, happened to have been a Wren looking after Baran when we were operating from Harwich a year or two earlier. So she and I decided to go to the up to London for the celebrations of VE Night. And we had the most extraordinary time. We started down in Limehouse and we finished up in the middle of London. And we caught a train back in the general direction of Portsmouth about 4 o'clock in the morning. But the total and absolute joy of the whole populace, and the generosity with which they were giving each other things or asking you into their homes or whatever, is a sort of blurred, ecstatic period which I shall never forget in my life. And I think I must have slept most of the next day because I don't remember feeling that I did anything very clever about learning how to be first turned to a fleet destroyer. However, when my appointment came out, my mother had moved back to our home in Bexhill, where she'd been evacuated from. They'd put barbed wire and landmines in front of the house, which was on the sea. She'd unfortunately fallen down and broken a leg, and there was nobody to look after her. So I was given compassionate leave to go and look after her and keep the show on the road while she was in hospital. And the Admiralty always made use of people like me who were, in effect, between appointments. And so I was told that my job was to go and encourage the war effort and speak at various factories, different factory every day of the week. And I was told by the Admiralty which train to catch and which factory I was going to and, broadly speaking, what they made. And so I found myself down in the Thames estuary talking to an outfit that made turbine blades and turbines. I finished up somewhere else where they were making mine clocks and mines.
And what sort of thing did you tell them?
Well, one of the things which had been taught to me in the gunnery school when I was a sub-lieutenant was that bullshit baffles brains. And so I set out. I have about 20 minutes during lunch hour in these factories, having been introduced to the board or senior people first, to be told what the factory made. I had to adjust what I was talking about to match the things they were making and tell them how important they were and how much we valued what they were doing and to give them a feel for what way we use these things. So I remember in a canteen where everybody was thumping their knives and forks against the plates, and I could hardly hear myself think, but I did have a microphone. My criteria for whether I was winning or not was whether the noise abated and they listened to me, or whether the noise got greater and they all got up and left. In practice, with one of them, I vividly recall I was winning, and I had some story from the Mediterranean coming out about how dawn was rising over one side and I waved an arm to the side the dawn was coming, and from the other side the aircraft came in to attack us with the dark behind us and us silhouetted against the sun, and the guns did this and the bombs did the other. And at that moment there wasn't a chap eating his lunch. All the knives and forks had stopped, and I felt that was success. However, one way and another, I was not appointed to a fleet destroyer in the Far East because the war ended out there as well. So instead of doing that, I went to train boys at Shotley.
So you went to Shotley sometime in 1945,
yeah.
And you were the boys' divisional officer.
I was. Shotley had been closed during the war to boys and opened up to Chinese ratings, among other things. There were a lot of Chinamen there. And I was among the first group of officers sent there to reopen it for boys' training, knowing nothing about boys' training myself. But we had petty officers, chief petty officers, who had themselves been boys at Shotley, and one or two ex-ratings who'd also been boys who were, in fact, divisional officers. Shotley, HMS Ganges, a very large area between the two rivers, Eek, in Suffolk. Harwich on one side and Felixstowe the other side, just by the entrance there on the landward side. And from nothing, we built up to about 600 boys there quite quickly. The boys we took in, many of whom had broken homes during the war, they'd been evacuated, their fathers perhaps had been killed, all sorts of things had gone wrong in their families, and some of them had been given the option by magistrates of joining the Navy or going to Borstal. So they were a tough bunch. There were also those who were mad keen on a naval career and who came in for those reasons. And we put them into an annex for the first few weeks they were there. And we fed them, you must remember there was rationing everywhere, we fed them on as much bread and butter and jam as they wanted and gave them good meals as well. And we issued them with their uniforms, allowing an extra 2 inches around the middle of all the uniforms, and they filled them out in about 8 or 9 weeks. When they'd done their initial training and learned how to put on their uniforms, they were moved across to the main area of Ganges, and I had Drake Division there, which built up to 300 boys, and we eventually had over 2,000 in the establishment. At about that time, I got engaged to Peggy, and by then I had a lot of boys in my division, and they were most amused that I should be engaged and about to be married. Having checked that none of them lived anywhere near where we were going to be married, I invited anybody who lived nearby to come. And to our horror, 6 of them accepted. It was a large wedding, despite the fact that Peggy got measles, and the thing had to be put off. And then she said no, she couldn't face a big wedding. And then she began to feel better. She felt she would like a big wedding. So somewhere there's a whole series of invitations which record this.
They can't see you.
They can't see those. And a large wedding was eventually held. Peggy's mother stood back from the receiving line, much to the surprise of all the guests who came, and wouldn't shake them by the hand. And as they passed down the receiving line and out, they were all looking at her to find out, you know, why on earth she was behaving in such a weird way. And it was only that evening that she admitted that actually she'd caught measles from Peggy and didn't want to give it to all the guests. So we set off on honeymoon, which had been delayed, but I couldn't be given any more leave from Shotley. So we had a foreshortened honeymoon and eventually came back to Shotley and lived in the house which was being run by Paymaster Captain and his wife, who was very old Navy indeed. He insisted on having candles and a 4-course dinner every night from his wife, who served it to him rather than eating it with him. And we felt this was very odd indeed, and Peggy rather hoped I wouldn't be doing that to her later. But my interest in games was allowed to come forward again.
Well, tell me about that, because you seem to have spent a lot of time doing sport at Shotley.
It really stemmed from my interest at school as well. I'd been in the first 11 at cricket and first 15 at rugby and first 11 at hockey and won the public school rackets championships 2 years running and been in it for a third year, which was very unusual. And I'd played, as my partner in rackets, was Peter Kershaw's brother, Tony. We've mentioned Peter Kershaw as the first tenant of Conn. Tony Kershaw had been killed flying a Spitfire in Battle of Britain. And I found, as I gradually drifted back into British life as opposed to naval life, that a very high proportion of my friends at school had been killed. Those of us who went flying in the late 1930s, I think out of 18 of us, only 13 were alive by the end of 1943. And my chance to play games myself again started again at Shotley. Well, being very keen on it, I was able to enthuse the boys in my division, and they won a lot of the competitions. But it was the sort of full-time work where boys were in groups of 30 in dormitories. I had a chief petty officer and a petty officer for each of my dormitories. And I had 300 boys altogether, so I had a lot of dormitories. In those circumstances, they used to riot occasionally, and I got to the point of allowing my chaperels and pereelses, instead of punishing them themselves or being responsible for them, I would get the boys up at 4 o'clock in the morning and run them up and down a hill for a bit to take the steam out of them, take them onto the river to pull 12-oared cutters against the current, then come back to the establishment to cut the grass on a bank with their scissors in time for hell of shower and change my breakfast. Now, one of the things which surprised me, because I was new to this boys' training bit, was that they had to be inspected in the bathroom, shower room, and they would go in 30 of them at a time with their chief petty officer and petty officer, and then they were fallen in, having washed, absolutely starkers. And the chief petty officer was with me, very reliable man indeed, had been a boy there himself, said, "Right, carry on, sir." I said, "Yes, please, chief," wondering what he meant. And he said, "Right, you lot, back foreskins." Then we had to march down and examine that as well. I found this very difficult to handle, and inquired of the doctors and other people whether this was in fact necessary, and was told it was a good idea. But it was not what I thought I would be doing at that particular stage of my career. I didn't do it as a matter of course either. If the chief petty officers and petty officers thought this was necessary to keep the dirty little so-and-so's clean, well, great. They did it. We also won the football matches. We won various other things. And as we increased in size, I found that an establishment with 2,000 boys, it needed a lot of parsons as well. We had three or four of them, and at least one of them was making all the boys who turned up. I was an altar. I served at the altar and rang a bell at the right time, and I wasn't a very high church sort of person. But I did rather resent one of the parsons telling my boys that they had to confess to him as well, give confessions. So I put a formal complaint in about this and found that this went up to the chaplain of the fleet in no time flat. And some tactful way out of the impasse I'd caused by actually complaining about this, which wasn't really my partnership, was found, and it was made optional. It was, in fact, a full-time business from very early in the morning till late at night. And we had a huge mast there. Before the boys came back from St. George in the Isle of Man, I was told that we were going to have mast drill the next day. We all fell in at divisions. I suppose there must have been about 500 of us there at the time. And I wondered what mast drill was, but I hadn't liked to ask, because I thought I ought to know, perhaps. And the commander turned to me, called me over, and said, "Sir, lead your division over the mast." Well, the mast had come out of the original Ganges, and it had a lower boom about 30 or 40 feet up from the ground. It had another boom way above that, and it had a pole right up at the top, about 15 feet high.